Let me ask you this. Is there a movie that you've watched a million times? You know, that one that you just can't stop watching? All summer long, our fellow NPR program, Weekend All Things Considered, has been asking filmmakers, actors, and writers about the movies they never get tired of watching. Today, we bring you this one from a comedian and actress turned talk show host.
Hey, I'm Whoopi Goldberg. And the movie that I could see a billion, zillion, gazillion times and have is To Kill a Mockingbird, directed by Robert Mulligan. And of course, Gregory Peck is in it, Brock Peters, and just amazing people. I think the first time I saw it, I was probably 10. I was by myself. But I told my mother about it. And I said, "You saw this movie, what's called it?" She said, "Yes, I've seen it. Did you like it?" I said, "Oh my God, it was really great." And Boo Radley, I want him to be my friend. I was an odd child, you know.
Boo only comes out at night. When you're asleep and it's pitch dark. When you wake up at night, you can hear him.
There are a couple of scenes in it that kind of knocked me out, but the very first one that sticks with me is the scene when we first meet Boo Radley. We feel him throughout the film, but we don't actually see him. Boo Radley saves the kids on Halloween night from being hurt by Mr. Yule.
Run, Scout! Run, Scout! Run!
When you get a character like this, who you're waiting for, and you can't imagine what he looks like, and suddenly...
Oh, there he is, Mr. Tate.
He's behind the door, and the door moves, and it's Robert Duvall, and Scout looks at him, and she says...
Hey, Boo.
Hey, Boo.
Miss Jean Louise, Mr. Arthur Radley.
It just is beyond.
I believe he already knows you.
And those performances are spectacular. It's what I strive for. It's what I want as an actor. I want to be that good. In the midst of all of that, a trial is held that Atticus takes on.
Atticus, you heard about Tom Robinson?
Yes, sir.
It's a black man who's being accused of hitting and coming on to a white woman. And it is very clear, because the black man has only one arm, that there's more to this story than is out there.
There's been some high talk around town to the effect that I shouldn't do much about defending this man.
If you shouldn't be defending him, then why are you doing it?
For a number of reasons. The main one is that if I didn't, I couldn't hold my head up in town. I couldn't even tell you or Jim not to do something again.
For one little kid watching this movie, you sort of get the sense that it is all right to be around people who stand up for what is right and how difficult it can get.
I was to think of these days many times, of Jim and Dill and Boo Radley and Tom Robinson and Atticus.
That's Whoopi Goldberg talking about the movie that she could watch a million times, To Kill a Mockingbird.
And finally, this hour, we're right in the middle of Hollywood's blockbuster season. Theaters are packed and running films that studios consider most likely to succeed. Our critic Bob Mondello says they're especially confident about one form in particular.
Imagine you're a movie producer, and you've got a couple of $100 million to gamble on a single massive blockbuster. What genre do you suppose will be your safest bet? Superhero? Action-adventure? Sci-fi? All of those have had huge successes, but they've also all had hugely expensive failures. There is one genre, though, that's hardly a gamble at all. It's been almost foolproof since it first came into being in 1995.
You saved the day again, Woody.
You're my favorite deputy.
You got a friend in me.
Pixar's Toy Story was the first computer-animated feature film, and it started a revolution. In the last 17 years, the major Hollywood studios have made about 70 more, and only a handful of those studio-produced films have made less than $100 million at the box office. The really big hits? have made much more.
You definitely need some Tic Tacs or something, because your breath stinks!
Shrek and its various sequels and spin-offs have taken in more than $3 billion at box offices worldwide, and the three Toy Story movies...
I am Buzz Lightyear. I come in peace.
...have taken in about $2 billion.
Money, money, money!
A mark that the Ice Age movies will almost certainly reach this summer.
Hey, there really is a rainbow around every corner!
The Madagascar, Cars, and Kung Fu Panda franchises are no slouches either, at more than $1 billion each. Small wonder that we'll soon be seeing Despicable Me 2, Cloudy 2, Revenge of the Leftovers, and a sequel to Monsters, Inc. called Monsters University. Computer-animated sequels are so reliably successful that if you've got an idea for how Nemo could get lost again, I'll bet Pixar would listen.
Dory, do you see anything?
Ah! Something's got me!
That was me. I'm sorry.
And box office revenues are barely the beginning. DVD sales are in the gazillions because young kids love to see these movies again and again. And the characters are tailor-made for toys. Some of them even are toys.
T-O-Y. Toy.
Excuse me. I think the word you're searching for is Space Ranger.
Not to mention everything from sheets to collectibles to theme park rides. All of this comes with advantages on the production end, too. Star salaries, not necessary.
Tome de chevre de pay! That would go beautifully with my mushroom!
Ratatouille took in $600 million with its leading rat, voiced by Patton Oswalt, who is hardly a household name. And because actors only need a few days to voice a whole movie, even big stars don't demand million-dollar paydays.
Okie dokie, belly bye, all tucked in, sweet dreams.
It also helps that animated movies are a snap to dub into other languages.
Okie dokie, a la camita.
Because there's no disconnect when an animated character's lips move and Spanish comes out, or French, or whatever. Which is helpful with overseas markets looming ever larger on studio balance sheets. All of which speaks to why the Hollywood studios are so fond of computer animation. And audiences? Well, initially there was the novelty factor. Teens and adults had long been leaving cartoons to kids, but these new digital characters seemed startlingly lifelike, and they sounded hip and clever enough that for the first time since the early Disney years, animation was attracting everybody.
Wally!
Not just children. It is possible to make a computer-animated dud. Disney did it with Mars Needs Moms, and smaller companies that don't have the merchandising power of the big studios have had misfires. Also, digital animation isn't cheap, so $100 million grosses don't mean animators all get limos. But the two companies that have led the digital animation revolution, Pixar Disney and DreamWorks Animation, which is home to the Shrek and Madagascar movies, have between them produced 17 of the top 20 computer animated features, and in the process grossed a bit over $13 billion, not counting DVD sales, toy sales, or theme park rides. Why, you have to wonder, would the studios make anything else? I'm Bob Mondello.
Hey, I know that guy. It's, Wally! That's it! Hey, Wally!
Wally! Hi, Wally!
Hey, it's your buddy John! Hey!
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Okay, it's time for the latest installment of our series, Watch This. Hollywood insiders tell us what films they'd love for us to see, new or old, famous or not. And today we get recommendations from Lisa Kudrow. She's best known for her role as Phoebe in Friends. Lately, she's been playing a creative but self-absorbed therapist in Web Therapy, now on Showtime. Her list begins with an old black-and-white movie. The movie is called Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House. What is this?
Oh, it's the best movie. It's Cary Grant, Myrna Loy, Melvin Douglas. It's about these people who live in New York City, mm-hmm. and their apartment is too small for them. You can see them overflowing. And they decide to buy a house in, I think, Connecticut, and it's falling down. And it turns into a money pit. And by the way, I don't remember when this movie was done.
1948, I can tell you that.
Well, thank you. But it's the exact same. Nothing has changed in the world of purchasing a house, renovating it and the costs that escalate, you know, and then the stress between the couple, and the dialogue is really sharp.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of this. So we have Cary Grant here and Myrna Loy discussing with a contractor, I believe, the possibilities of renovating this old house that they've discovered.
The house and the lilac bush at the corner are just the same age, Bill. If a lilac can live and be so old, so can the house. It just needs someone to love it, that's all.
What did your engineer say when he checked the foundation in that roof?
Now, who needs engineers? This isn't a train, you know.
I just saw it move.
I just saw it move. It's that kind of dialogue throughout.
Do you learn something when you're watching actors of the past like this?
Like this, yeah, because everything's thrown away.
What do you mean?
The jokes aren't hit very hard.
You mean just a smooth remark and things go on as if nothing funny has happened. It's like you could almost miss it.
Right. It's like, well, I saw it move instead of, well, I saw it move, you know.
Cue the laugh track.
Right.
That kind of thing. You've got another black and white here, All About Eve.
Well,
and,
yeah.
And my goodness, Betty Davis playing an somewhat aging actress and dealing with a fan who actually wants to replace her.
Right. And she's a theater actress, and that's always fun to watch. Because she's extremely dramatic and insecure. But again, it's the dialogue that every line is so precisely perfect. Especially George Sanders is in it. And mm-hmm. He's always worth watching.
All right, George Sanders, that's not a name that I think most people know. Who's he?
He mm-hmm. always plays that guy who just sort of walks into a room and eviscerates everyone, you know, with something he says. And I've always been very attracted to those characters, I guess, because it's not like me. something I've always aspired to, walk into a room and destroy
fire.
Someone.
You know, I was just watching a clip from the new program of you with Meryl Streep, and Meryl Streep appears to be that kind of character.
Oh, yeah. She was fantastic. That's improvised, too. So that's just her brain.
I really apologize for imposing on you this very sad day for you. I didn't realize you were going to a funeral.
No, I'm not going to a funeral.
Oh.
Why would you think that I'm going to a funeral?
Oh, I'm so sorry. You were dressed in a way that looked so sad, and...
I don't think it's sad. I think it's just...
In
chic and
sort of denial.
Well, when you say improvised, I mean you set up the situation. You give her some kind of, or do you not?
No, we do. We write an outline so we know where the story's going, but then it's all improvised within that. How you get to it and how you justify those things.
Mm. You have also sent us the movie Ordinary People,
mm-hmm.
directed, if I'm not mistaken, by Robert Redford.
That's
in
right.
the early 80s. And this is a very, very serious film mm-hmm. about a very disturbed young man.
Yes, about, family dysfunction. And they did suffer a tragedy which derailed the family. And I think one of the more compelling characters is, of course, Mary Tyler Moore's character. She plays the wife of Donald Sutherland and the mother of Timothy Hutton. And the mother who lost a son. And what I like about this movie is I saw it when I was a teenager. And then whenever I see it again, you know, as I've gotten older, I have a new perspective on it. Just because now I'm a wife. And then I'm a mother.
Hmm. And so it's almost like it's a different movie when you watch it 15, 20 years later.
Right. That's why I'll watch it every time it's on. I love, you know, watching Judd Hirsch as Timothy Hutton's therapist, because Timothy Hutton's character was with his brother when he died. He drowned. They were both out on a sailboat at sea. And, you know, because he had so much trouble dealing with it, he tried to commit suicide. And the mother, who just keeps saying, why don't you, you're not trying.
Hmm. But what makes her more sympathetic now that you're a little older and seeing that movie again?
Because of the unfathomable tragedy that happened to them. She lost her son. You know, how someone deals with it, to me, is beyond judgment.
Well, let's play one more selection you've got here. And this is something that is not going to be hard for people to find. You can find it in 10 seconds on YouTube. Yo-Yo Ma and Lil Buck. One is a great musician. He's out on a... balcony somewhere, and mm-hmm. who's Lil Buck that's with him?
Yeah, I think this was at a charity event. Someone sent this link to me. And I couldn't believe my eyes. This is Lil Buck, and he's, I think, improvising this dance. And he moves like it's not human.
He's a superb dancer, unbelievably flexible, and it's like he's a leaf flying on the wind almost.
Right, exactly. And I mean, it's the ultimate in interpretive dance to me.
The amazing thing, too, is, I mean, he appears to be reacting to the music as Yo-Yo Ma plays it. And at the same time, Yo-Yo Ma is watching the dancer as if perhaps the dancer's latest moves are affecting what Yo-Yo Ma will play next.
Yeah, I noticed that, too. These things inspire me, that kind of artistic connection, you know?
So when you improvised that scene with Meryl Streep, did you say, look, Meryl, it's just sort of like Yo-Yo Ma and Lil Buck?
Yeah. Which one do you want to be?
Lisa Kudrow, this has been very fun. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And the second season of Web Therapy is now on Showtime. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
The line between fiction and reality keeps growing thinner. A new TV series premieres Sunday called Political Animals, starring Sigourney Weaver as an ex-First Lady who becomes Secretary of State. It was created by Greg Berlanti, who also created Everwood and was the executive producer on Brothers and Sisters and Dirty Sexy Money. Our critic-at-large John Power says that the show is revealing both for what it is and isn't about.
If you only knew about America from watching TV, the last few months might lead you to think that women here wield enormous political power. First, you had Game Change, the story of Sarah Palin's attempt to become vice president. Then you had Veep, in which Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character has accomplished just that. Now comes Political Animals, a new USA Network series about a strong female Secretary of State, who I suspect even a Martian would realize is based on Hillary Clinton. Sigourney Weaver stars as Elaine Barish, a smart, controversial ex-First Lady. After losing her party's nomination to a charismatic upstart, Paul Garcetti, played by creepy handsome Adrian Pasdar, Elaine surprises the world by doing two things. She accepts President Garcetti's offer to become Secretary of State, and she divorces her husband, ex-President Bud Hammond, a narcissistic southerner with zipper troubles, played by the Irish actor Kieran Hines with more braying Belfast ham than winning North Carolina charm. Judging from the vigorous, if overblown, pilot, Political Animals is about how Elaine juggles her tricky relationships with two different presidents, her boss, whom she finds annoyingly slippery, and her ex, whom she can't quite resist, and how she deals with her two very different sons. Douglas Hammond, played by James Walk, is the smooth, dutiful one who fits easily into the Beltway ecosystem. In contrast, TJ, played by Sebastian Stan, is gay, does drugs, and can't bear the political life. More tellingly, perhaps, Elaine also finds herself developing ties to a D.C. reporter, Susan Berg. That's Carla Gugino, who's written nastily about her in the past. Here, the two are aboard the Secretary of State's plane during a flare-up with Iran. Susan asks Elaine what keeps her going.
How do you do it? And even people like me who have criticized you really do admire your resolve.
My usual answer is that I share the ethos with most Americans. If you work hard and give it everything you got, tomorrow will be better than today.
And the truth?
Most of life is hell. It's filled with failure and loss. People disappoint you. Dreams don't work out. Hearts get broken. Innocent journalists die. And the best moments of life, when everything comes together, are few and fleeting. But you'll never get to the next great moment if you don't keep going. So that's what I do. I keep going.
Political Animals was created by Greg Berlanti, a specialist in family melodrama who clearly cares more about the animal side of Washington, its weaseling and dogged compulsion, than about its actual politics. This is too bad. I've recently been reading The Passage of Power, the fourth volume of Robert Caro's riveting biography of Lyndon Johnson, a book that makes Berlanti's show feel not just thin, but naive. Caro knows how the political life engages the whole person. He gives us the dirty, low-minded stuff, And LBJ was certainly carnal in every sense. But also the serious daily work of, say, passing civil rights legislation, and the moral arguments for doing so. By comparison, Political Animals is, well, a political animal. Berlanti knows that film and TV studios don't want to risk alienating their audience by getting into the nuts and bolts of government process, much less by talking ideology. The Newsroom may wave its liberal politics like an Adlai Stevenson banner, but most political movies and shows pointedly do not. Veep, for instance, is cynical, not ideological, while Game Change focused on everything about Palin except what she actually believes or why she connects to millions. Even the news coverage of this year's election has spent less time on Obama's and Romney's ideas than on the tiniest tactical details of their campaigns. Now, it can't be denied that basing a show so clearly on Hillary and Bill betrays a certain failure of imagination. But this, too, is the American way. Our best political novels tend to be based on real people. Just think of All the King's Men. And few political pairings could be more tempting than the messy Clintons. They turned the White House into a reality show, which Berlanti has now turned into a fictionalized potboiler. Only time will tell whether that's an upgrade. At the moment, it looks like one for Hillary Clinton, whose reputation has never been higher. She's finally escaped her husband's shadow. If he became the flawed hero of Primary Colors, she's now the center of a mashnote of a TV series, one that gives her surrogate most of the good lines. At one point, Elaine is talking to President Garcetti, who it's clear has been a bit of a wuss. Before she leaves the Oval Office, she says calmly but crushingly, "Someday, sir, it would be nice to be working for the man who beat me." I don't believe Secretary of State Clinton has ever said anything remotely like that to President Obama. But it's interesting, don't you think, that in this election year, a new TV show implies that she'd be entitled to do so.
John Powers reviews TV and film for Vogue and Vogue.com. Political Animals premieres Sunday on USA Network. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Yo-Wei Shaw. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.